Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And since the world first learned about the Tsarnaev family, there have been no end of unanswered questions about who they are, how they function within the family unit and outside of it, and how they ended up and why they ended up on Boylston Street on Marathon Monday. A team of Globe reporters have put together a personal and family portrait of the Tsarnaevs, which helps flesh them out. Joining us in Studio 3 is one of those reporters, Patricia Nguyen. Patty, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. So this is a massive series about the whole family, both of the young alleged bombers. I guess we still have to call them alleged bombers. But what's the takeaway? To me, what was so scary is that what you reported is that this was less about a radicalization in their religion and almost more about mental illness and a falling apart family.
Yeah, I think that we came away from it thinking that the whole sort of language of jihad and radical Muslim, you know, movements is sort of the language of it. But behind it is mental illness, a chaotic family. In the case of Jahar, a kid who whose life was falling apart and probably sort of borrowed the template that his brother offered.
Let's start with his brother, with the older brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who obviously was killed, as we know, on that Thursday night in Watertown. And mental health issues, hearing voices in his head. Fill us in on some of the things you guys reported about that.
Well, Sally Jacobs, my colleague, did most of the reporting on that. But what she found were several people who said that they had heard him complained that he was hearing voices. Now, again, it's hard to know. He never saw a psychiatrist. He never saw a mental health professional. He was never officially diagnosed. But there were people who discussed, you know, physicians who heard this too, who heard it indirectly from someone else, that, you know, did he have some sort of schizophrenia? Did he have some sort of paranoia? Mental health issues were floating in the minds of people.
You know what's fascinating to me is when I skimmed it the first time before I actually read it closely, I'm saying, well, it's not surprising he didn't get psychiatric help because a lot of families are still don't like that, what they consider to be pseudoscience or showing you're weak. But then when I read it in more depth and saw that the parents themselves had sought and received psychiatric help, why then was the mother so resistant? I think it was the mother was so resistant to the love of her life, the older son, seeing a shrink. Where was the disconnect
there? I
know.
I mean, that baffled us, too, because you'd think that maybe they were one of these families that feels like, you know, it's kind of you should be ashamed, shameful
exactly.
to see a psychiatrist. I can only think that, either they just had a disconnect there, like it's fine for us but not for our children. Of course, the other thought that has floated in my brain is when they did seek psychiatric help, it was shortly after they got here. And I do sometimes wonder whether in their effort to seek asylum here, was there any effort to need to show some impact of trauma? But
From what happened before.
Yeah. You know, was it even somewhat legalistic? On the other hand, you know, clearly they didn't just go to this particular psychiatrist once or twice. And it was ongoing.
Let's get a picture of this family. So they come here together, and the father did say he had been captured by Russians and tortured. But give us a picture of the family when they came.
Well, when they came, the parents came with Jahar first, and the older brother brought the sisters. They lived in a they through family some connections. They found this 800 square foot apartment in East Cambridge. I've seen the apartment. It's small, but they managed in there. And you get the impression that in the early years, they probably seemed like this immigrant family that had high ideals. My reporting focused on Jahar. And in speaking to the teachers that knew the parents, they seemed to be this family that cared about education and would look into things. And I think that they put a lot of their eggs in the Tamerlan basket in terms of his boxing career. And I think that was going reasonably well in the beginning. I think one of the most fateful decisions they made as a family was to force Ilina into her arranged marriage. I think that was almost a quasi-political decision because she ended up being assigned to marry.
How old?
She was 16 when she got married. And she was assigned to marry the father's brother's wife's, nephew or something. But it was almost like a family, like, oh, you know, I'm going to, I don't know whether it's curry favor there or something. And it was obviously a miserable marriage. It lasted, you know, I don't know, barely a year. But she was a free spirited child. Everyone told me Ilena was a wild child. She was a free spirit. And I think to force her into that, I think took up and sucked up a lot of emotional energy in the family. And I think even Anzer has been reportedly told people that looking back on it, it was a mistake. And I know that Zubaydah, the mother, confided in many people who she knew at the spa where she worked. She agonized about this marriage. And I feel that that's kind of one of those untold stories. But you can imagine in a home where a daughter is going through this, and then this marriage that you hope is going to, like, connect the different branches of the family tree. And no, it actually is spectacularly awful.
Was it that daughter later, or was it the other daughter who ended up dating a non-Muslim, and the non-Muslim ended up getting, what, punched in the face by Tamerlan as a message?
No.
You don't. Is that the other one?
Is that
Bella?
That's Bella. That happened at Cambridge Ringe in Latin. You know, both of them had married men from their homelands. Those did not work out. Both had sons by that marriage, and then actually, Bella's, I can't remember some, but anyway, and then they each had a child with that, and then now they are in new relationships.
And they're both in Jersey, from what I recall, have been arrested for marijuana charges?
Well, Bella has been arrested for marijuana charges, and Ilena has she has various other things. She's, you know, has an arrest here for obstruction of counterfeiting.
When you said, Patty Wynn, that from the Globe, that you've seen the apartment, you mean physically you've been in the apartment?
Yes, after obviously this whole thing happened.
What's it like walking through the door knowing that the two brothers and their family live there? I mean, what's that like? You know what I mean? In a visceral sort of way, what's that feel like?
You know, it's just one of those weird things. You know, every time you go someplace and you think, hey, you know, but 4 months ago, this thing looked like, you know, it was just a normal family living here. Who would have known? You go up to the third floor. Of course, by that time, you know, the FBI had been through
sure,
it.
Sure, but still, but they lived there, and they had plotted there, and they whatever there. I mean, it's just,
Yes, and then meanwhile, you go there, and they still leave a few things. I mean, when I was up there, there was a copy of the Quran was still there.
And then
you see, like, stray sheets of paper, like an application for Section 8 housing, and you see a book, like some sort of almost like SAT prep book. And there's little, like, of these mundane signs of a struggling family. And
we're talking to Patricia Wynn from the Boston Globe. She and a team of reporters have written fascinating stories about the fall of the House of Tsarnaev, about Zohar and Tamerlan and the whole family. You know, I remember early on interviewing a woman who went there for facials. Mm-hmm. And because apparently mom was pretty good at giving facials. But I thought, when I learned it was an 800-square-foot apartment, they had shoes all over the stairway going up there, and you go in there for two-hour facials.
Right.
I mean, either she was like a miracle worker at the facials, or this was strange behavior.
Right. Well, she probably they did cut up the apartment, so there are technically, you could say, three bedrooms, but like they're really, really small. I mean, barely basically bed can fit there. She probably, you know, made one of the rooms, I'm guessing, into kind of her own space, and you know.
So let's get back to Zohar, because he was supposed to. Tamerlan was the brawn, and Zohar was supposed to be the brains, and he did start out pretty well in the schools in Cambridge. Tell us about his youth and growing up into teenagehood.
I think that Zohar was kind of the youngest of four children. I think that he sort of flew under the radar, but was the kind of kid that could easily fly under the radar. I think he's one of these kids that's sort of born as, you know, he's sort of adorable, he's smart, he's athletic, and he has kind of my sense was a sweet disposition, easily likable. And so it was kind of easy, if you imagine this family, they're having this, you know, trauma over their daughter's arranged marriage falling apart. You've got Tamerlan and his just loud personality, the parents' financial struggles. And so then you go along, and I think Zohar was, you know, he did fine. Then I think in high school, though he graduated as captain of the wrestling team, you know, National Honor Society, those sort of things, he actually had, I think his decline actually began a little bit in high school.
Based on what?
Well, for one thing, even though he graduated with a B average, if you actually look at his grades, each year they went down. I mean, in other words, the average grades as a freshman is a B plus. By the time he was a senior, it's C plus. It's a gradual decline. I'm not saying that's you could tell right away, but that's some sign of it. You could tell he was smoking pot a little bit more, whatever. But that's true of a lot of teenagers. I think what happened is that he probably was somewhat troubled before that, but it was hidden because he had the structure of the school and the team. And
the wrestling team. And actually, if I recall correctly, at his first arraignment, didn't the wrestling coach actually show up? I believe he actually went to the arraignment.
Yeah. He was a really good wrestler.
And he was captain of the wrestling team for two years. And think about the structure of wrestling, and you have a team, and he's captain. I mean, so he has a lot of reasons to feel reasonably good about himself. I think what happened is, he goes just at the time he goes off to college, his parents get divorced, they go to Dagestan. And he gets to, his parents aren't the kind of parents that drop him off on the first day of college.
It seemed like maybe
Tamerlan. Maybe it was Tamerlan, but his roommate can't even remember.
Dumped his stuff and took off.
Right. And so I think that he gets there, and I think that he lost all sense of structure. And I think that the other, whatever troubling aspect of Jahar that was brewing in there, I think kind of just, it sort of accelerated, intensified.
Speaking of staying on Jahar, by the way, my kids both, I've said this before, both went to middle school with him, one ahead of him, and they had the exact same reaction when they heard that you've heard from absolutely everybody who knew him then, all the words used, adorable, warm, decent kid, and then goes to CRLS, Cambridge, French, and Latin. But at the beginning of the piece that you all wrote, you summarize what you think are some of the major conclusions. And one is fundamentally recast the conventional public understanding of the brothers, showing them to be much more nearly co-equals in failure and growing desperation and in conspiracy. Obviously, everybody knows that the primary defense, this is not in your piece, the primary defense this young man is going to use to avoid the death penalty, whether Judy Clark or whatever it is that essentially was under the spell of his older brother. And I don't mean that, obviously it's not a term of art, but you know what I mean. Is when I'm reading the piece that you did on Jahar himself, you talk about when he's told not to party so much or whatever, but Tamerlan, he basically says to his brother, mind your own business. I'm going to go do what I want. Then he ends up doing $1,000 a week marijuana selling business at UMass Dartmouth, which is no small money. He spent a lot of time in New York. Is it because of his independence that you all drew that conclusion that he was not somebody who was told what to do by the brother? Because you can see in the Tamerlan story, you can see seeds of something deep and horrible growing. You really don't when you read what you wrote about Jahar. He's a troubled kid. He's got a dysfunctional family. He's selling weed and not studying anymore, like a ton of other young kids. So my long-winded question is, how did you draw the conclusion, all of you, that they were morally co-equal in conspiracy? Is that because he was an independent player?
Right. I think that, I think it's more sort of like a personality profile at that point. If you want to sort of assess people more by actions than by words, it was clear that while Tamerlan's telling him, don't party, don't go out, don't drink, don't smoke, Jahar does it and does it reasonably openly. And so he openly defies his brother throughout the summer before his sophomore year in college. And I don't get the sense, and even talking to his friends, that Jahar was the kind of person that was just kind of like, I'll do whatever Tamerlan says. I mean, I think there was a respect to his older brother, but, they're like almost 7 years apart.
Right.
And so I think there is a respect, but I don't think that, I think the template in that family of being kind of a maverick and being your own person or, whatever, doing it your own way is there too. So I do not see Jahar as that meek, bullied young brother.
But can I just continue that for 1 second? You read the Tamerlan stuff, you say to yourself, and I want to be careful saying this because I know people are listening and saying, hey, there are a lot of people who are really screwed up who don't do horrible things. So this is not an attempt to defend their behavior, but to try to explain it. When you read the Tamerlan stuff, you can see him on Boylston Street. At least I can. When you read the Jahar stuff, and then at the end of your piece, you have the infamous, we Muslims are one body, you hurt one, you hurt us all, they scribbled on the boat. You say, how did he get from that totally screwed up kid, but screwed up in the way so many young people are, to being a mass killer?
I mean, right. I know. Well, like I said, when I, in doing this reporting, I too had this idea that, like, you have these, like, the good kid and then the bomber, and it's just way the dots are way too far apart. I do feel that in my reporting, I felt like I got a better sense of how Jahar might have been able to get on Boylston Street, in the sense that he did have, especially more over the last couple years, I think more of a risk taking, thrill seeking, also a little bit of a I can get away with a lot of stuff.
He could always talk cops out of it.
Like, people are saying, like, he was the white guy among their friends who could sort of charm police officers. And that I think that he had a sense of, like, you know, I can talk my way out of things. I found it was interesting, the photo that I'm sure you've seen it a million times, of Tamerlan and Jahar right before the bombing at the marathon site. And you have Tamerlan in glasses and his cap is on. But Jahar, his cap is turned backwards, yeah. Right? His face is right out there. I mean, it's almost as if Tamerlan tried to conceal his identity, but Jahar didn't. I mean, think about it. After this happened, Jahar goes back to UMass Dartmouth and goes right back to classes, goes to a party.
We had a call on the phone a couple of days late when they finally captured them. Right. A guy who we thought was making it up saying, I was at the gym the day after, and who walks into the gym but the younger Tsarnaev.
So he thinks he could get away with
things, again,
too.
But again, I guess the thing is, if Tamerlan is hearing voices, he has some mental health issues, he's becoming radicalized in his religion, he's lost his opportunity to become an Olympic boxer, which was a dream of his and stuff. Okay, so you can, as Jim said, you can see all that. But what I don't get is, obviously, if you're going to the marathon with bombs, you are going to maim and kill and injure lots of people. So the violence, that's the part. I mean, it's one thing to be a pothead and to be going to New York with your friends and spending money on liquor and all those kinds of things. But to become a killer who's going to kill children.
I know.
Mean, that's what – could you Would see you, that at
no,
all?
No. I mean, I have to say, in all my reporting, I did not see that Jahar – I mean, quite frankly, he seemed like someone with a good heart in that sense.
Yeah.
Someone who was generous with friends. I mean, the idea – I mean – you know, maybe I hate to say this, but maybe sort of setting a bomb seemed like an easier way to commit violence than if he actually looked at somebody and stabbed them. You know, I mean, it's kind of not a very intimate way to, you know, to do your violence. Kind of you put it away, you walk away. I think that if Jahar were left to his own devices, I don't think this would have happened. I think that whatever perfect storm of psychological factors converged, and I think that Jahar, I think Tamerlan provided the sort of the ideological template for this, and that Jahar sort of was at a point where his life was spinning out of control, and in whatever reason, he joined forces with Tamerlan. I will add that I don't think Tamerlan maybe could have pulled this off without Jahar, though, because Tamerlan's so disordered, and I think that. Think about it. To detonate two bombs fairly simultaneously, first of all, you think you have to have a dry run once or twice, and to actually do it successfully and, you know, get the ingredients and have the cash to do that, sometimes I wonder whether Tamerlan could have done that by himself.
You know, one last thing for me, Patty Wen. We're talking with Patricia Wen, who did this reporting with her colleagues at the Boston Globe about the Tsarnaev family. One of the big themes here has been, you know, Congressman Bill Keating talked about this, going over to Russia and finding out from the Russians that they were really concerned about Tamerlan. From what we've read from you, the Russian influence seems to be almost not even a factor, that this was not about him, Tamerlan, being radicalized there and the FBI goofing it up, much as I love to blame things on the FBI. This was very unpredictable.
Well, can I interrupt that just for a second? I don't think it undercuts Keating at all. It may undercut the Russian story about how he's meeting with radical Islamists. Keating's contention, as he said to us many a time and said in his letter to the FBI, when you got the information, whether it was true or not, your failure to communicate that to people in positions of power in law enforcement or Boston. Ed Davis himself said at the committee hearing in front of Congress, we would have gone and checked them out on Norfolk Street.
It raises to me questions about if they even had any information based on the trip to Russia. If the Russians are lying, basically, is what I'm saying. It sounds like to me. I could be wrong. I have no idea.
Well, I mean, David Filipov and Sally did most of that sort of side of the reporting, but my sense of it is that you know, should they have watched him? It sounds like he did have some suspicious sort of behaviors. If he was trying to connect with the radical elements there, you know, as David Filipov pointed out in his reporting, I mean, he shows up and he has kind of his hair with olive oil. I mean, he stands out. I mean, his sort of oddness and eccentricity stood out.
Yeah.
And as David said, you would not allow someone like that to join the extremists. So,
Patty, when I know I speak for Marjorie and myself, we both thought this was terrific reporting. But on the flip side, just for a minute, there's every single time anybody does anything, even of not nearly the scope and breadth, you guys have been working on this for 5 months of what you and your colleagues did, there is all, especially if they come close to the conclusions you do, there's always a lot of anger saying they're trying to say they weren't terrorists. They're trying to say it's mental health and dysfunctional family. A lot of us have mental health issues in our families. A lot of us have dysfunctional families. You know the end of the sentence. We don't go to Boylston Street with bombs to go kill people. But specifically, there's a mother of two brothers who, Norden family, who both brothers lost a leg. It's one of the most incredible and horrible stories, but their resilience has been staggering, I have to say. Liz, I think is the mother's name, is in the Herald today basically saying she was really upset about the series. I think for the reasons I said, it sort of undercuts the terrorist thing and all that. What's your reaction to both involved families and others making that claim? What's your reaction?
Well, I have to say I was really surprised to see Liz Norden in the Herald on this because she and I have a relationship going back to the very day of the bombing.
The mother,
Liz Norden, when I met her outside Beth Israel Hospital, you can look at the front page of the Boston Globe the day after the bombing, and I have an interview with her where she talks about worrying about her sons, hearing they're each missing a leg. And since that time, she and I have stayed in very close contact.
Really?
I mean, I've met the brothers at the hospital. I've been at their home, at events. And so as a result, she knew I was working on a story about the brothers. And I told her that when it was coming out that I would let her know. So when it was finally coming out, actually, the day before it ran, I gave her a text message. And I said, hey, Liz, just want you to know this is probably going to be very painful. It's a long series, but I just want you to know it's coming out. And she texted me back and she said, you know, that her sons find this painful to read, but that she wants to sort of consume as much as she can about what happened.
And because she wants to learn?
She wants to learn. And she said she's become obsessed and this is part of her healing, is to try to understand more about what happened. So I guess what I would say is to those who ask why the Globe did this, I actually think that this is something that happened. It was huge in our city. And I think that we want to try to wrap our heads around sort of why did this happen? I mean, how do you prevent things from happening if you don't better understand
it? Well, except the one thing, Marjorie said this to me upstairs, and I think the one reason why this kind of reporting extensive is troubling to people, forget the putting aside those who suffer directly, like the Norden family, is we all want to, but we talked to a good friend of ours always from Jack Levin from Northeastern, who's probably the world's premier expert on mass and serial killings, about was Lanza preventable? Was Aurora preventable? That sort of thing. The more it's mental health and family backdrop, and the less, this is the point Marjorie made to me this morning, unless it's terrorism related, the more unpreventable it becomes.
And unpredictable.
You know what I'm, and which I think is unsettling to people because you worry, is there another Tsarnaev family living on another street in greater Boston?
You mean, is there another family that's having
exactly.
a toxic mixture of psychological problems?
Has a history not dissimilar to this, and it's not really terrorism, at least according to the piece the four of you wrote. And that's unsettling. People, all of us, I include myself, want it to be something that when we hear the end of the story, we can convince ourselves we could stop the next one. And it's a lot harder to believe you can stop it when it's a family and it's mental health and those sort of things. That's
well, it. What I want to say to that is, hey, this is real life. I mean, look, everywhere. Is there another family out there right now? Is there another teenager? Is there another young man, woman, anyone who's capable of some sort of, you know, erupting in violence? Of course there is. And I mean, so when you say preventable, I would say this. Then you have to look at, obviously, and I know this sounds way too broad, but you have to look at schools, other people, and you have to look at, you know, identifying mental health issues. I mean, I will say one thing. When Ilina had this arranged marriage, which I think is pretty unusual, right?
At 16? Oh, my gosh.
I will say this. Cambridge came out in many ways wonderfully, and from what I sense, the support they gave Jahar, whatever. But it was also known to educators in Cambridge that Ilina was having an arranged marriage. And again, you know, you can say in this world of multiculturalism, whatever, that you don't want to look like you think that's troubling. Like, oh, I'm not going to bring those parents in because they're having an arranged marriage because I don't want to look like I'm whatever, anti-Muslim, anti-traditionalism. But on the other hand, if you ask me, that was a red flag, okay? If you want to look at a family and you say, oh, yeah, you're forcing a 16-year-old girl who you know to have a very kind of free spirit, and you're telling her to have an arranged marriage, and then you don't sit there and say, hey, let's bring that family in. Is that a missing red flag? So my point is that maybe what this is to my mind, a wake-up call that we just have to be more alert to all kinds of different signs. And I'm sorry if it's not a simple black and white, good guy, bad guy, simple answer. But I think what the Globe tried to do is show the full complexity of the situation.
And you did it beautifully, I should say. Patricia Nguyen, Sally Jacobs, and David Filipov are responsible. It was in yesterday's paper. It's online. And we really thank you for your time.
Thanks for being here, Patty.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with Tufts professor Peniel Joseph about my favorite story of the weekend, a Fox News proclaiming that Santa Claus and Jesus are white. Get over it, kids. Get used to it. That conversation up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.